The USDA has released an updated plant hardiness zone map. This map looks significantly different than the last one that came out 22 years ago. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day, and we'll talk today about the new plant hardiness zone map. We'll find out why you might not want to invest in a lot of Zone 5 plants just yet. We'll also talk about what it takes to transition your garden to organic, and we'll take a look back at the last growing season and talk about some of the problems organic gardeners encountered. My guests today are Kathleen Dellett, a professor of horticulture at Iowa State, and Richard Giron, ISU Extension Horticulture. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and we're going to focus this hour on organic gardening. Kathleen Dellett is a professor of horticulture at Iowa State University and an expert on organic gardening. She'll be with us in just a moment, but we're going to start the conversation today with the new plant hardiness zone map released from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension is here to help us decode the map. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here today. And this is the first new plant hardiness zone map released since 1990.
Correct.
And Iowa looks significantly different on this map than it did on the last one. What is the difference?
It's a little bit different. Zone 5 has moved to the north. Now, when you look at this, this is a guide. It's a nice guide. Don't consider it to be carved in stone. I would probably tweak it a little bit and maybe increase the size of 4B in northern Iowa. And so basically anything north of maybe Sioux City to Dubuque, I would still consider it to be zone 4B.
Okay, and the you say zone 4B. There are three zones represented in Iowa, 4B, 5A, and 5B. And you can take a look, by the way, at the new map. If you go to our Facebook page, you can click on the link and you can see how Iowa is divided up now. And on the map as a whole, there are actually more zones than there were on the last map.
Well, they divided the zone 5 into A and B. It used to be just basically zone 4 and zone 5. So now they have divided into zone 5A, 5B, and 4B. So southeast Iowa is basically 5B. Much of central Iowa is 5A. And northeast Iowa, northwest Iowa is in zone 4B.
So does this map represent a climatic change? I mean, you mentioned that 5B or zone 5 has basically moved north.
Correct.
Is this pretty much uniform across the country where you see zones moving north?
Right. They have moved north in response to the warmer weather since basically 1976. So they've taken that into account, and they have moved the zones a little bit farther north.
And since they've broken 5A and 5B into separate zones on the map, is there a little more precision on this map than in past maps?
They've done that in the past, too, but most people would just use the zones 4 and 5. They wouldn't break it down, but they did that in the past, too. So gardeners can use that. They can look at that and kind of fine-tune what they want to plant. But just keep in mind, it's a guide. We still can't grow oranges and grapefruits and bananas and things like that. So it's a little bit farther north as far as the zones, but beyond that, not a big change.
So you wouldn't change your behavior based on this map, it sounds like.
Well, what possibly people in northern Iowa, let's say like, for example, Spencer, Mason City, they're classified now basically in 5A. I would still plant mainly things hardy in Zone 4 in Spencer and Mason City. And you might want to experiment with some zone 5 plants, just a few plants, just to see how they do and then go from there.
When you're sitting down with the catalog or you're going to the nursery to pick out plants, what else do you need to consider other than the zone?
Well, hardiness is very important. You also want to consider, for example, if they might be drought tolerant. We can have dry conditions here in Iowa, and that can limit the adaptability of some plants, so look at that. Look at if they are susceptible to a major pest. For example, you would not plant an ash because of the potential for the emerald ash borer at some point, so you wouldn't plant that. If you're looking for a crab apple, make sure it's an apple scab resistant variety. So look at pest resistance. So look at weather conditions, maybe drought, soil conditions. If you have, for example, a heavy clay soil, choose plants that can tolerate those conditions. Some plants will not. So look at the composition of the soil. Look at the soil pH. If you want to plant a pin oak or a river birch, make sure you have an acid soil. They don't like alkaline soil. So those are all considerations.
And even if you are solidly in zone 5, you also need to think about the location where you're putting the plant, right?
Correct. In that, let's say in zone 5A, if you live in the city itself, it's going to be a little bit warmer than if you live in a rural part of the state where it's very open, it's very exposed. It's a little bit different environment.
All right. Well, and as I mentioned, you can see this new USDA plant hardiness zone map if you go to our Facebook page and click on Iowa Public Radio. And let's turn now to organic gardening. Of course, you're welcome to join our conversation this hour, whether you're a conventional gardener or an organic gardener. But I want to bring Kathleen Dellett into the conversation. She's a professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. Kathleen, thank you for coming back.
You're welcome, Charity. How are you doing today?
Great. Nice to have you here. And right now, a lot of people are in the planning stage of gardening, and some people might be considering giving organic gardening a try this year. What do we need to think about if we're going to turn an existing garden plot into an organic garden?
Well, the good news, Charity, is that probably the majority of gardeners out there are doing things organically. So unless you're putting synthetic fertilizer or synthetic pesticides on the crops in your garden, chances are you already are an organic gardener. There's two types, really, of organic gardeners. Those that opt to do it 100% according to the USDA National Organic Program certified organic rules, which actually are quite simple to follow. I'll describe them in a minute. And those that grow things organically but really don't care about regulations. They don't sell to anyone else, so they don't need to worry about adhering to regulations. But the regulations are basically, in a nutshell, that in order to sell you any crop as organic, it has to be for 36 months, there has to be no prohibited substances on that garden. So no synthetic fertilizers, no synthetic herbicides, fungicides, insecticides. And so instead of using synthetic products, organic gardeners, farmers rely on natural products like compost for fertilization. You can also buy organic fertilizers that are sold at, well, even Earl May is selling them lately, and you also can order them online. And then instead of using pesticides, you're just relying on mostly preventative measures.
Do you think that there are some misconceptions about organic that make people a little frightened of it?
Well, I don't hear that so much from gardeners, but certainly farmers worry, if I can't use herbicides, what am I going to do about my weeds? I'd say that's the number one concern for transition into organic for large-scale operations. And I'll just take weed management as an example. Again, I mentioned prevention's the key by having crop rotations and also using crops like rye, a cover crop of rye that has a property called allelopathy that helps mitigate against weed seed germination and growth. And then there are various mechanical methods. You can use tillage. Of course, in a garden, you can use your tiller, you can use your hoe. And we're actually working on a robotic weeder here at Iowa State.
How does that work? Or does it yet? But how will that work?
It's still in the experimental phase, although we're going to be testing it at the horticulture farm this summer. I'm really excited. It's Professor Lei Tang in the Ag Engineering Department here at Iowa State. And it's equivalent to an eco weeder, if anybody knows those out there in the listening public. And that the eco weeder, someone actually sits on the back and manually moves the tine weeders around the plant to do the weeding. But with Dr. Tang's robotic weeder, he's actually has a sensor in there that can differentiate between soil and plant or weed. And I don't really understand all the mechanics of it, but I've seen it, and I'm excited to test
it
out.
It sounds really exciting. Maybe if you need a test plot further east, let me know.
Okay, I'll tell it.
We certainly have some weeds over here. Let's look back at the growing season of 2011 from the perspective of organic gardeners and organic farmers in the state of Iowa. What were some of the major problems that cropped up?
Right. Well, I always compare to 2010, where it was floods. And so, of course, we were put in all our new drainage system this year out at Hort Farm. And then it was a drought in the middle of the summer. So we did have to irrigate more. So, I mean, especially if you're selling or intending to sell any organic produce, I highly recommend that you have an irrigation system at the ready. Drip irrigation's the most efficient. But it is more of a capital outlay. It's not really that expensive. It turns out we did put in an extensive one at another site this year, and I think it came in something like $400 for probably half an acre. So it's worth it. It pays off in the long run to put in a drip system. We continue to use overhead irrigation at the horticulture farm because that was the cheapest and most available we had out there, and it worked fine. Of course, we had our usual suspects, Japanese beetle that we love so much. They were there, and actually the Hort Farm is the only place we find them. We don't find them at our other sites, thank goodness. But if you have a small-scale operation, you're going to be doing a lot of hand-picking, hand-smashing. That's what we do as our first level of management. But then you also can use some organic approved, or they call them organic-compliant insecticides, such as Pyganic, which is a combination of pyrethrum, which is made from daisies and some other natural ingredients. And that worked pretty well on managing the Japanese beetle. The other thing we tested this year was a somewhat disease-tolerant tomato variety called Defiant from Johnny Seeds. And it shows some resistance to early blight and late blight, which to me are the bane of organic gardening in Iowa. And it also tasted good, because usually when they breed for disease resistance, you're going to lose a lot of taste characteristics. But this was actually a very tasty variety that didn't get very much disease till the very end of the growing season. And turns out it does have some genes from heirloom tomatoes, those tomatoes that give you all that flavor. So I think that was the combination that worked. So those were just a few of the things we ran into and tested this year.
Well, and you mentioned using organic pesticides. Is that another misconception that some people have when they think about the possibility of going organic, is that there aren't any pesticides that they can use?
Correct. That definitely comes into play. And yes, there are, I wouldn't say hundreds, but certainly enough organic compliant pesticides out there that, should your preventative measures not work, should your biological control not work, for example, there was no effective natural enemy of the Japanese beetle, then you can go to an organic compliant insecticide that's made from natural sources.
I'm talking with Kathleen Dellett of Iowa State University and Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension. You're welcome to join our conversation as well. The number to call is 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and I'm talking today with Kathleen Dellett from Iowa State University. She's a professor of horticulture and an expert in organic gardening and organic farming. Richard Giron is here today from Iowa State University Extension Horticulture, and they are here to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Kathleen, before the break, you were talking a little bit about one of the strains that you used that was bred for disease resistance but still had great flavor. What other kinds of organic vegetable research has been going on at Iowa State?
Good question, Charity. Thanks for asking. What we're trialing is a new system called Organic No-Till that we're really excited about. And it came to us from Rodale Institute out in Pennsylvania. They donated this implement called a roller, It's 10 foot long and about 16 inches high. And when you fill it with water, so it weighs 2,000 pounds and carries a lot of weight, and you hook it on the front of a tractor or the back of a tractor, the best is on the front, and it rolls and crushes a cover crop, like hairy vetch and rye is our most popular one, that you plant in the fall. Then you come in the spring and you put this roller out there and crush it. And then you can plant your vegetables. You can transplant vegetables into it, or you can seed. We've used corn, beans, and Rodale's done it with squash and strawberries, for example, and pumpkins. And then that mulch, that crushed cover crop, serves as a dead mulch to protect against weeds the whole season long. And when it works, it's absolutely great. When it doesn't crush and die, you're going to have to go back and roll it a couple times. So you might want to wait before you plant. Actually, we've gone, Rodale likes to do it what they call one pass operation, but we've taken to wait and see if the cover crop will completely die before we plant. So it'll be more like a two or three pass of the roller before we go in and plant. And folks can actually see a picture of it on my webpage if they go to Iowa State webpage and just put in the word organic in the search engine, I'll take them to the Iowa State Organic Ag Program webpage. And we also have a brand new extension publication that should be uploaded next week. It's called PM 2086, Growing Organic Vegetables in Iowa, that they can find out more information about this no-till organic system.
How effective is that to have the mulch laying over the ground? I mean, when you talk about controlling weeds, does it control weeds entirely?
That's the ideal. And some years it's amazing. I know, for example, with University of Wisconsin, who's a partner on the project, they showed us pictures this year, and they had, I would say, 98% control of the weeds out there. We've been doing it now for 5 years, and I'd say out of the 5 years, maybe 1 year we had that level of control. But you tend to have higher weed levels and therefore higher tolerance of weeds in organic production without it seriously affecting yields. And in gardens or smaller scale vegetable operations, the good news is you can go back in and put your regular mulch. In this case, we'll use oat straw. You can also use wheat straw on top of the rolled cover crop.
Is there something particular about rye that makes it especially effective when used in this way?
Right. Rye is really good in that, I mentioned, it has this property called allelopathy, where its roots particularly, but some of the above-ground biomass too, actually produces these exudates, these chemicals that work against weed seeds germinating and growing. So it's a pretty nifty thing, and it also works. I mean, you see some of it with oats, and there are clovers too that have allelopathy, but rye has the most allelopathic properties.
Well, and you mentioned using other kinds of regular mulch in gardens. What about just dried grass? Can you do that? Take it from your lawn and put it on the garden?
Sure. That's a really good thing. The thing about it, it's pretty lush, so it's going to degrade a lot more rapidly than, say, a dry straw that has a lot of lignin in it.
All right, so you might have to repeat more often.
Right.
But meanwhile, to get that kind of control.
Right. But meanwhile, you also will be getting a little more nitrogen probably from using grass clippings compared to straw.
All right. Well, we will continue to talk about developments in organic gardening and farming throughout the hour, but we do have some callers on the line that I want to get to as well, and you're welcome to join the conversation at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Brian is on the line from Robbins. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how are you today?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I was wondering, I grow apples, peaches, and plums, and I have a terrible time with beetles, the Japanese beetles. And I heard you mention the application for gardens. Would that work on my trees, too?
It would. That certainly can be tried. The other thing is I've seen people actually go to putting nets on their trees, too, to keep the beetles off. I don't know, Richard, have you run into any other alternative?
Well, you definitely don't want to use the traps. The traps actually attract more Japanese beetles than they catch, so don't use those. You might have some organic insecticides that would be appropriate. But the key there with the Japanese beetles is that they continue to emerge from typically around mid to late June through July into early August, so that you have, if you use an insecticide, whether it's organic or a chemical, the key there as far as control, if you use that, is to do it frequently, because you can kill what's there, but more may emerge and fly into the area over time, so you have to do it frequently.
Can you use the microbes on the soil below the trees? Would that help in killing the larva? Or is there anything that would kill the larva?
Well, you can use insecticides to kill the grubs in the soil. The problem is that these adults, the females, lay their eggs in any grassy area. And so this would be roadsides, pastures, whatever, including lawns. So if you just treat your lawn, okay, that's just a small area in the whole entire landscape, and that's not going to have much of an impact on the population in the area because they can fly. So just treating your lawn or your area probably won't have an impact on the population.
So you're saying that I need to, because of rain and other environmental conditions, I would need to continue to spray from mid-June to the end of the season.
Well, you would have to spray frequently because over time, they don't emerge all at once, the adults.
Mm-hmm.
They emerge over several weeks. And so you may go out there in late June and find your first crop of Japanese beetles. And you may spray and kill them, but a few weeks later, new ones have emerged and flown to your area. So you have to keep on doing it, basically.
Okay.
But we found, and when we did, as I mentioned, the two-pronged approach of doing a lot of hand smashing and then applying that Pyganic, that we only had to do it, we only sprayed twice. So, I mean, I agree with Richard, but you should definitely monitor, too, because
right.
if your beetles are gone, no need to spray.
Right. If they're not there, they're not there.
I had my first peaches this year after 10 years, and they were just pits on the stem by the time the beetles were done with them.
Yeah, the Japanese beetles like things that are nice and tender and very easy to eat. And you think of roses, you think of fruits like peaches, those things they just love.
Well, and Brian, unfortunately, you weren't alone. We heard a lot of people calling up to say that about their peaches this past summer. And it just didn't seem to be a good summer for a lot of different kinds of fruits. Hopefully we'll have a better year this year. Alan is on the line next from Ames. Hi, Alan.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
I was just wondering if you had any recommendations for any sweet cherry trees that would work well here in central Iowa, if any of them are hardy enough for that.
Okay. In the past, we would say simply no, that they weren't reliably hardy. I would look for either black gold, it's kind of a dark reddish black,
okay,
or white gold. Those came out of Cornell University in New York. They are self-fruitful. You only need one tree. And they should be hardy at least to Highway 20 in Iowa. So you should
okay.
be okay.
All right, great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Alan. And next up on the line is Shannon from Iowa City. Hi, Shannon.
Hello.
Hi.
I have another apple tree question. I have a very large, probably 40-foot apple tree that's in the parkway here in downtown Iowa City. And so I want to learn about how I can trim the tree, but also thinking about the city and there are power lines going through it. And I want to see if I could get the production to be better because they're really wonderful apples, but how I can work around all this wire and such.
Well, you may have to hire someone to do that in that situation if that's going to be a hazard. But as far as pruning, the first thing that I would do, I would go out there and prune out or have pruned out all the dead or broken branches. That would be the first thing that I would do, is to remove those dead or broken branches.
Okay.
Then I would prune out any branches that maybe hang too low, that get in the way as far as traffic or whatever, okay? So get rid of those. And then once I've done that, if the tree is quite dense still, I would do some thinning, where you simply remove some of those branches to kind of open up the canopy a little bit. And that actually leads to a better crop. So the first thing, prune out any dead or broken branches, prune out any branches that hang too low. Also prune out branches that might grow straight up. We call those water sprouts. And sometimes you'll see those when you do some pruning where you have these shoots that grow straight up. Prune those out. And then once you've gotten rid of all those, then maybe do some thinning of the entire canopy.
Okay.
But Shannon, I will warn you, as one who faced the wrath of the city of Ames, check with the city of Iowa City first, because we did some work on a tree in our yard, and they came along and cut the whole thing down. And they don't have to tell you they're going to do that. So you may do all this work on the apple, and then they decide that it's a nuisance or something. And, I mean, if it's on their property, you better check with them before you do anything with it.
Okay.
One thing you don't want to do is to go out there. You said it's a big tree. You don't want to go out there and simply have the top of the tree removed or top the tree. You don't want to do that. So that might be your initial thought. It's getting it to be a big tree. It's getting in the wires to simply go ahead and top the tree. You really shouldn't do that. What you can do is if you have some branches that grow quite tall, maybe look back on those branches and maybe find a really very healthy, sturdy branch that's more horizontal and cut it back to that point and reduce the height somewhat that way.
All right. Good luck with that, Shannon. Thanks a lot for your call. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And while we're on the subject of pruning, Burton sent us an email from Cedar Rapids. He says, I may be overthinking this problem, but I would normally be looking for a spot of good weather to start pruning things that prefer dormant pruning. With all this warm weather, does the timing change?
Not really. As far as if you have some oak trees, go ahead and start pruning those. We typically suggest pruning those in December, January, February, into early March. So you have plenty of time on that. So keep on doing that. As far as pruning, let's say, fruit trees, maybe raspberries, I would probably put that off until maybe late February at the earliest. And then you have the month of March, which is fine, too.
All right. And since we were talking about the warm weather, this is an email from Joyce. She says, I live in Burlington, and I noticed this morning that my daffodils are up a half an inch. Do I need to worry and do something about covering them up, or should I just let nature take its course?
Well, you can't really do much, unfortunately. This does occur on occasion where, especially on the south side of a building or west side where they're close to the foundation, the ground tends to stay kind of warm there. And that does encourage early growth, so it's not unusual to see that. There's not much you can do. I would not cover them with snow. With soil. Just leave them exposed, basically. But if we do get a snow, I would probably take a shovel and carefully bury them with additional snow.
Okay.
Because the snow does act like a blanket, protects them. So they're not exposed to the extreme cold, and it also discourages any additional growth. So if we do get some snow, I would actually cover them with additional snow.
All right, and you may just have that opportunity
this weekend.
You may,
yes.
All right. This is a question that takes us outside of our normal garden parameters. This is for you, Kathleen. When switching to completely organic seed and field crops, using corn as an example, how much yield adjustment can one usually expect?
Well, we now have 13 years of research on that very question because we've been comparing conventional seed of corn with organic seed down at the Neely Kenyon Farm in Greenfield, Iowa. And we've been, over that 13 years, they've averaged exactly the same. So the good news is the organic seed industry has really advanced as far as corn and soybean options. Vegetables are still a little bit behind. You may not be able to source 100% organic seed for all your vegetable varieties you want to grow. But there's been, every year, there are more and more organic varieties around. So yeah, the good news there is there are excellent varieties of organic corn seed available that can give you the same yields as conventional.
Well, and let's talk about organic seed, because what makes the seed organic? I mean, we've talked about organic gardening and organic farming processes, but starting with organic seed is something else entirely.
True. Yeah, I did leave that out of the equation in the beginning, because you can still get an exemption from the certifier if you're not able to source the variety you want or need for your market, if you can't find that as organic. But as I said, more and more organic seeds are being sold every year, so it's easier to get. And so what that would entail, Charity, is that seed, the crop that the seed came from, was raised 100% organically. That is, take, for example, corn. That corn crop was grown without any synthetic fertilizers or pesticides, and then the seed was combined, saved, cleaned, and then sold as organic.
And from your perspective, Kathleen, what difference does that make?
Well, it's almost a twofold thing, in that to be certified organic, they want to support the whole organic system, and the system begins with the seed, what actually begins with the soil, but then next is the seed. So it's connected to supporting the whole system and supporting the whole organic industry, including the seed industry. But there's also an issue a lot of times with conventional seed. They will be treated. They'll be treated with synthetic fungicides, for example, or insecticides. So you need to definitely be aware of that, because you can't plant those. Even if you get an exemption, you still have to plant untreated conventional seeds.
All right. Kathleen Dellett is here today. She's a horticulture professor at Iowa State University, and Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. You are welcome to join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and we are here to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With us today, Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension and Kathleen Dellett from the Horticulture Department at Iowa State. She's a professor of horticulture and also an organic gardening and organic farming expert. So if you have questions about organic gardening, feel free to give us a call, 866-780-9100. And we do have a few more lines open for your questions. We also have a lot of emails coming in at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And this one is from Lauren in Fort Dodge. He said, we had to have tuck pointing done on our chimney. The contractor built a shelter and had to cover up two of our rhododendrons. He had to get it fairly warm in there for the mortar to set, and it was warm enough to fool the rhododendron into thinking it was spring. They put on buds and started to bloom. The contractor finished and removed the shelter. Will the cold temperatures we experienced in January harm the plants? Will we lose them, or will they survive?
Only time will tell, and I think the key there would be how cold it may get. If it were to get extremely cold, let's say minus 15, minus 20, that's going to be a lot harder on that plant than, let's say, 5 or 10 degrees. So that's going to be the key. How cold does it get over the next few weeks? Not a very good situation, because it has started to grow. But I think it may survive if we don't have any very cold extremes.
Could they cover it again, Richard?
No, I think I would just leave it. And I guess the nice thing is I don't see any extremes over the next week or so as far as the forecast. And I think normal temperatures will kind of re-harden the plant a little bit. And so that would be beneficial.
All right. So that may put them back into a dormancy.
Right, and they might survive it, because the nice thing is that woody trees and shrubs do have two sets of buds as far as leaf buds. And when they leaf out that first set, if something like a cold snap or insects destroys that first growth, they can use that second set of buds to leaf out again. So they can survive something that's rather bizarre.
All right. Tom is on the line next from Fairfield. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I have a little cactus. I'm quite sure it's a Haworthia. I'm not sure if you guys are good on cactus or have any ideas, but This one I've had for 40-some years, and I think it got watered too much. So I'm just concerned that the roots may have died. However, the top is still green. Some of the lower part has dried up and is not green, unfortunately, anymore. Any ideas?
I'm not familiar with that specific plant. Is it multi-stemmed, or what does it look like?
Well, it was originally one stem, and it had some children, you might say. It had some little offshoots that acted the same and were just smaller, but there's one main kind of stem, you could say.
Okay.
It has thick, somewhat triangular leaves with little bits of white on them that all come thickly from a stem, so you don't see a stem, an elongated stem or anything. They're just all coming out.
Okay. Well, if it has some small stems, what I would be inclined to do, since the plant may be in the process of slowly dying, my thought would be to maybe take off some of these small stems, if you can, and try to root them so that if something does happen, if it does proceed where it does continue to decline and eventually dies, the main plant, then you would have these rooted cuttings. So that would be my inclination. Where you take them off, you cut them off with like a razor blade or a sharp knife.
Cut off exactly what? I've got leaves coming out of a main core, but not independent stems showing up.
So you only have one main stem then?
It is one main stem. I'm just picking the thing up, and it just came out of the soil. Now, maybe it's just too late, in other words, there don't seem to be roots going into the soil, but the top is still quite vibrant green.
Okay. And how tall is it?
Oh, a matter of inches, like 3-4 inches.
The stem?
The whole plant stem and all. There isn't any discrete stem.
Okay. Well, I guess I would maybe just wait another few weeks, and if this rotting continues at the base, if that seems to be getting worse over time, then I would just cut off the top, make sure where you cut it, it is basically solid, firm, healthy tissue. There's no rotting occurring at that point. Then set it on the counter for maybe a week or so, where that cut in has a chance to kind of callus over, and then try to root that either in some perlite or some coarse sand. You want to keep it moist, but not too wet. And coarse sand, perlite should work. You can also, before you actually stick it into the perlite or sand, you can dust the bottom with a rooting hormone that would encourage rooting. It may also contain a fungicide that would discourage rotting, and try that.
Well, best of luck to you, Tom. I hope things work out. You can join our conversation by calling 866-780-9100. Judge is on the line next from Fort Dodge. Hi.
Good morning. My question is, I know you've been talking about this is a good time to trim oak trees. I was just wondering if it's also a good time to trim honey locust trees.
You can. I'd be inclined to wait until maybe later on, but yes, you can. Most of our deciduous trees, like maples and lindens, honey locust, we would trim those typically in late winter, early spring, March, early April, right before they begin to leaf out. You could do it now, but I would be inclined maybe to wait a little bit longer if you could.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. And we've got a couple of emails here for you, Kathleen. This is from Janine. She says, last year I had a tomato hornworm infestation for most of the summer, which I controlled by picking the worms off the plants. Is there an organic method of control that is more efficient and less yucky?
Well, one thing about being an organic gardener, you have to definitely get away from thinking it's yucky and
embrace the yuck,
as you say, sure. And, usually I just pick them and I wear gloves, I'll admit it, and pick them and throw them into a little pan or bucket and the ideal is feeding them to the chickens. They love hornworms. But barring that, you can smash them, throw them into your compost pile. Okay, but if you want to spray something, there is a product, a typical trade name, not giving any endorsement, but Dipel is the product we use. It's a natural formulation of a bacteria called Bacillus thuringiensis. And it's good for all caterpillars. Now, the thing about it is you have to get it on when they're young because it'll take a couple days for it to react. And it's actually they actually have to consume the leaf with the BT on it. And then it'll cause basically a stomach virus or a problem in their stomach. And then they'll die. So you'll see them actually hanging on the plant in a blackened, bacterially infested form. So that's kind of yucky, too. It's all natural, though.
You mentioned giving them to the chickens, and I've heard some people talk about inorganic gardening, using chickens or even ducks in some cases, chickens to help with pest control, ducks to help with weed control. Have you ever experienced with that?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I have a funny story, too, to tell about that. They are very good, and they're used around the world for weeding. There's a Mother Goose organic coffee plantation in Hawaii that uses geese to weed in between their coffee plants. Now, coffee's a perennial. It's got a tough woody woody plant. So, you know, if the geese occasionally peck at it, it's not going to hurt it. However, we tried to use geese on a broccoli planting in an experiment I did in California. And I'll never forget the data entry that my brother wrote in my logbook. Geese ate experiment. So if it's a lush plant, you definitely will have to. They actually have duck herders, for example, in some countries that keep them off the commercial plants and just work on the weeds. But yeah, they're really good weeders.
All right, and good with all kinds of plants. How about using chickens in pest control? Have you tried that?
Oh yeah, again, you know, they're varmints. They'll peck at your plants, too. And so if you're out there monitoring them, I think they'll be fine. Yes, I've seen them. There's a farmer, Francis Tickey, down in Fairfield, and he's shown pictures of chickens just grabbing flies right out of the air. He uses them for insect control around his dairy cow operation. And he finds them very effective. But you know, he does. As far as putting them on plants, they may occasionally peck at the plants, so I would be out there with them.
Well, one of the things that I've heard about is using them. We were talking earlier about Japanese beetles on apple trees, and the caller was asking about is there a way to get them when they're in their larval stage, and I've wondered about herding chickens around the base of an apple tree or something like that in early spring.
Well, the larval stage is in the ground. I don't know how deep it goes, Richard, but they're...
I'm not sure either.
They're deep. You can't see them.
Okay. A little too deep, maybe.
A little too deep. We have used that bacterial formulation. It's another form of Bacillus. It's called Bacillus populi, and trade name Doom. Love that one. On turf to control grubs in turf. And that takes a while to react to, but it did seem to cut down on the population of grubs in our turf. You know, whether it works on Japanese beetles, I would definitely give it a try. But maybe some caller out there has used it and seen an effect. We have not tested it yet.
This is from Evan in Orient. He says, we have had good luck using a kaolin clay spray against beetles. Spray a dilute clay spray during times of peak pest pressure. A couple of sprayings confuse and deter most pests. It's a very affordable application and washes off after a few rains, leaving a nice fruit harvest. Have you had experience with that?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we did do several years of trials with a trade name product called Surround that's kaolin clay. And I know other people have tried to make their own formulations from clay and have had variable results. The Surround was effective against, in this case, we were testing against squash bugs and flea beetles and insect pests on cucurbits, squash plants. The problem was we didn't really have high populations in the control plants where we sprayed nothing. So I can say we saw some reduction, but it wasn't statistical because the populations were so low overall. But I definitely have heard people using that, especially out west in Washington State. When you go through the organic apple orchards out there in the spring, summer. You can see they're coated white with this kale and clay product, and they use it against apple pests, including codling moth.
Okay. We have a couple more callers on the line. Lynn is on the line in Riverside. Hi, Lynn.
Yes. I have a prairie question about a beautiful plant called Queen of the Prairie. I have several patches of it, and up until about 4 or 5 years ago, they're spectacular. And they have been, the last few years, they have blighted. They'll be lush and green, and then about when they set their blossoms, they blight, and it's very discouraging. And at first I thought it was herbal spray drift from the neighbor's corn thing, but as it spread in subsequent years across the prairie, I'm kind of think it's some kind of fungus that gets going from the cool, damp weather, and I was wondering how to handle that situation.
Well, it very well could be a fungus. I'm not sure which one. What you could do is next summer, if it occurs again.
I have several patches that I can experiment with.
Okay. What you might want to do is next summer, if it reoccurs, take some really good quality digital photographs and send those to Iowa State.
Okay.
Specifically to the Plant Diagnostic Clinic here at Iowa State.
Okay.
And their email address is sickplant, sickplant, at iastate dot edu. So sickplant at iastate.edu. And the staff will look at that. Maybe they can decide what that might be.
But also, you are very close to the Johnson County Extension Office down there, where Patrick O'Malley works. And I would take a sample of the plant itself showing the fungal problem to Patrick O'Malley. And I would bet he would if he's familiar with prairie plants, he would be able to help you out there.
All right. Good luck with that, Lynn. And I think we have time to squeeze in one last caller. This is Darlene in Fairfield. Hi, Darlene.
Hi. I was wondering if you can plant bulbs this spring. I mean, I know you're supposed to plant them in the fall, but what happens if you plant them in the spring?
Well, they typically don't perform very well because you plant tulips and daffodils in the fall so that they have a chance to develop a root system before winter, before the ground freezes. But they also have to be exposed to cold temperatures for like 12 to 16 weeks, and that occurs obviously during the winter months. So in the spring, they're ready to go. If you plant them in the spring, they're not likely to do much of anything. So it's important to get them in the ground in the fall of the year. What do you have at this point?
Darlene, what do you have?
You mean what kind?
Right.
Tulips, daffodils?
Yeah. The prognosis is not very good. I think on the daffodils, they tend to be much more vigorous plants. And so if the bulbs appear to be still solid and firm, I would get them in the ground as soon as you can. They're probably not going to do much this year, but they can regain their vigor and maybe bloom next year. Tulips tend to go downhill every year, so I'm not very optimistic on those.
All right, Darlene, thank you so much for your call. And Richard Giron, thank you.
You're welcome.
Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. Kathleen Dellett, thanks again for coming back to the show. I hope you'll come back again.
Love to, Charity. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks a lot. Kathleen Dellett is a professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Emily Woodbury. Technical support from Jason Burns in Ames. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Monday on the show, Our Daily Bread, The Essential Norman Borlaug, a new biography from Noel Wietmeyer. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.